please.
Senator Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 3194 authorizes cemetery maintenance districts to operate through boards of three or five directors.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have the illustrious chair of revenue, of House Revenue.
I love this committee.
The upper chamber.
Yeah.
Here.
Well-attended committee.
With a debt issue. And I'm really curious about your obsession with these morbid kinds of things. And if you could touch on the psychosomatics of that before or after you explain the bill, that would be very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll talk about that with you in the hereafter.
I don't have the wherewithal for the hereafter.
You don't have the wherewithal for the hereafter. The here and now, perhaps. Mr. Chair, Representative Lane Shatterly, State District 20, State Representative, House District 23, appreciate your attention to this. It's very brief. This came as the request of the Dallas Cemetery District, but has picked up the support of the Special Districts Association. We just have a statute that limits the size of board of directors to three, which causes problems. When there are only two and having to act with only two people. Also, there are some issues with public meetings laws when two of them are speaking together, engaged in district business, about having a quorum for various reasons, also including the thought that it would be worthwhile in Dallas. There's apparently an interest to enlarge the size of the board and get more input in the business of the cemetery district. They asked for a bill to expand the size of the directors to five. I thought that perhaps might not be fit for everybody. So we have a bill that gives an optional number of either three or five, and then the mechanics of how to do that. I think it passed the House by a vote of 55-0, and there is no opposition. I urge your support, and thank you for your attention.
Representative Shetterly, you know, I know you're an attorney and you're prone to exaggeration, but the note I have here says that it only passed 53-0.
Mr. Chair, I was counting the two votes who said they would have voted for it if they'd been there.
This wasn't something about the hereafter, votes that you were expecting to get.
Sorry, okay. That was another bill.
Thank you so much.
53.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Just amazes me that when people, criticize us for all the bills that we pass, that we have to do these kind of things statutorily.
It is amazing. I got a question about this actually yesterday. I said, well, the reason we have to do it because statute prescribes. It's true.
And so it makes you wonder, sort of originally, who felt that there had to be a... was it after a gunfight at OK Corral or something, and they were fighting over the cemetery? Or,
just to prove positive that government extends to the grave also.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, after the gunfight at OK Corral, there's only three left, so that's all I could...
Good point. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing.
You don't want to hear from...
What we will do...
yes, I understand.
If you will trust us, as soon as we get a third member here, we'll pass this momentous bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nice seeing you.
Nice seeing you.
All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3194, and you will remind me, please, that we will reopen a work session when we get a quorum here. We're operating without a quorum, folks, in case you don't know. So I see Representative Mabry's here, but we already did the public hearing on this, didn't we? Oh, we haven't. Oh, okay. Let's do a public hearing then on House Bill 2743. Would you tell us what that does, Mr. Ellsworth?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, House Bill 2743A permits the use of monies from the general fund to pay for operating expenses of the Oregon Veterans Home, and it prescribes an effective date of 90 days.
Thank you very much. We have Greg Warnock, Oregon Veterans Associate. Well, come up, Representative Mabry. And you can bring whomever you would like with you.
I got a room full of friends.
I see that. We'll not be intimidated. We'll probably pass this anyway.
Thank you. You threatened me that I had to be the picture of decorum, so I'll be very nice to you today. And thank you for your courtesy.
Sure.
should we have him? I don't really want him to identify himself. And wait, did you see the tie he has?
I was going to say, Representative Mayberry. Yeah, he's got the Senate leadership on.
I thought those were House members. He's got the Three Stooges on his tie. Please proceed before we get in any deeper trouble.
Thank you, sir. The bill before you is a. The only thing it does is remove a prohibition of using state funds. There are no state funds directly attached to this bill. All it does is remove the prohibition. As I was circulating the bill for co-sponsors and, you know, before it was released, the only comment that I heard of any kind of a negative way was the comment, something to the effect of, well, when we originally authorized the Oregon State Veterans Home, we were assured that there wouldn't be any general fund dollars needed to operate that. My response to that is, what are you, nuts? You really believe that stuff?
We'll close the public hearing. Oh.
That's not really my answer. But my real answer is that is absolutely true. That was a premise that was put forward and a premise that we would like to fulfill. Unfortunately, things change. In the original offer to build the Veterans Home, it was indicated that there would be probably up to as many as 150 Oregon State jobs with Oregon State wages and Oregon State benefits and those kind of things. As the thing passed through, those jobs went away. There was the indication that the state would operate that and it would be available to all veterans throughout the state of Oregon, regardless of their ability to pay. That also has changed because of the fact that we can't use any state money, to the fact that we can't even use state Medicaid dollars to supplement Oregon veterans who deserve to be in that facility but don't have the dollars to do that. As a result of that, we have a wing of our veterans home with a waiting list, but a wing that's unopened because we can't serve those veterans, and that's really an unfortunate thing. The citizens of Wasco County, I think, have been doing their part. We passed a $4.7 million bond issue to build the facility. Our local hospital is operating the facility at a loss. They're no longer going to be able to do that. We're looking for a new contractor, but again, the citizens of Wasco County are paying that. For the Oregon veterans to come in from all over the state and enjoy that wonderful facility for our veterans, and we don't resent that. We're not upset about that. Except we do think that it would not be, because things do change. And we're not, you know, laying blame. We're not saying, well, the state didn't follow through on their commitment. It's just things that happen. But the fact is, things do change, and we feel it's appropriate that if and when at some point that our budget gets to a point, the state budget gets to a point that the state could put in a few dollars to help veterans from other than Wasco County live in that wonderful facility, that we would be able to ask Oregon, the state of Oregon, for some of those funds, including the ability perhaps to, with a veteran that doesn't have quite enough money to get in, but they would qualify for Medicaid benefits, for example, that they could utilize some of those funds to supplement their stay in the facility.
So, Representative, I'm a little confused about the Medicaid general fund picture. Are you saying that a veteran who is a Medicaid recipient can't, because of the prohibition, go into the center now?
I'm saying that our facility that will not qualify, wouldn't even apply to be a Medicaid provider because of that requirement that we can't use any state funds, state general fund dollars, to do that.
Okay.
We would have to apply for and be accepted as a Medicaid provider, and because there are general fund dollars and Medicaid dollars,
right,
we can't do that. We haven't done that.
Thank you. Senator Minnis.
If I think Representative Mabry is right, based on the existing language of the bill, it doesn't allow for the general fund. And it doesn't even allow for federal fund under the way it's drafted here. So I'm just wondering if it may need an amendment to allow the reception of federal funds. I think think I'm going to trixie down to legislative council and talk to Holly Robinson and just check out
whether or not that's necessary. Okay, and we'll just continue on with it.
Because I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that is the best argument for the probation general fund, is that the ability to access other federal programs and have a 60-40 match.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that slightly, I certainly have no objection to Abbott or Harkin, Senator Menace. There's another representative. Yeah. Senator Menace, certainly happy
that's
to
his
have
boss.
Him.
The other representative Menace right. is his boss. Yes.
Happy to have him check that out. But we do accept other federal funds in the veterans. Dollars and those kind of things. So I don't think federal funds are exempted from being used. It's just state funds that we applied.
Maybe John Mangus.
John may very well know. He certainly knows a lot more than I.
He knows more than I do.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Representative Mavery, is that Curly on your tie?
And also Larry and Moe.
Oh, there they are.
And before you arrived, we were calling these the Three Stooges. But
and this was such a good bill before that comment.
Right. Had such promise.
It's really been a pleasure seeing you, Representative Croft. Take care and have a good day.
I'm going to watch you.
And, Mr. Chair, I also appreciate all the hats in the audience. That's what I understand the term is for all the veterans, is all the
caps.
Hats.
Okay, Gary Warnock and John Mangus, please. Welcome, gentlemen. I think you've got a fairly willing committee here, so if you can sort of let us know what the... I mean, and I've talked to Representative Mabry before about this, and I think he's given a fairly accurate picture of it.
Okay. You want me to go first?
Yeah,
do you want Greg?
You want
Director? For the record, my name's John Mangus, Director of Veterans Affairs for the State of Oregon, and here to speak in support of House Bill 2743, and would say that the governor does support this bill. We're here just to remove the bar from general fund, receive the general fund. And we're not asking for any general fund money for the 0305 biennium. The judge, or Representative Mabry, talked a little bit about how the home was conceived. It was in 1993, and the legislature passed the bill, the legislation to create an Oregon Veterans Home, but they specifically put in a statute, a bar to the receipt of any general fund, and appropriated $1 to create a construction account, which they never gave us. And from there, we put the, in order to build a home, they also gave me the authority to sell COPs, which seemed to be kind of a dumb idea because there was no way to repay the COPs once they had been sold. So we put the concept of a home out to bid to 232 different governmental units within the state of Oregon. And we asked $4 million from whoever would like to have the home in their community, up to 15 acres of land and some infrastructure financing. Wasco County was selected. They gave us $4.5 million. The city of the Dalles gave us $500,000 for putting in the streets, power, water. Two families from the Dalles gave us the 15 acres of land, and then we talked to the United States Army engineers into coming in and leveling a mountain so we could build on a level site. And then we applied for a $9.5 million federal grant, which we received, and we built a home. Home opened 1997. It's a 151-bed skilled care facility, 25-bed Alzheimer wing. And the initial idea was, well, the legislature also gave me authority to hire state employees to operate the home or to contract that facility out. The trouble with, since they didn't give us any general fund money, starting up a home, it cost a lot of money to front the hiring the staff and getting that operation going. So I elected to contract the operation of the home. We have two state employees at the home, and I returned the other 145 positions to a previous legislature. The first contractor of the home was Diversified Health Services. They contracted for 3 years. We went out to bid at the end of that three-year period, and we selected Mid-Columbia Medical Center to operate the second three-year period. That comes to an end this September, and the RFP for a new contractor is on the street as we speak, and which would be effective on October 1. The home was conceived, and it was the lobbyist for the veterans organizations testified that the home could operate without general fund money if a veteran was receiving what they call pension and aid in attendance and the average Social Security, whatever the average was. And that worked well until recently, and until the cost of health care, the inflation in the healthcare field, started increasing at a rate far beyond the COLA that was Congress authorized on veterans benefits and on Social Security. And today we're pricing that individual out of the home. The legislature gave me authority to create a trust fund, go out and try to raise money on the side. We've done that. I've received checks from one from a little old lady that was scratching. She gave a dollar. And it was probably a substantial part of her disposable income, but she tried to help out the home. We've received several thousand dollars from veterans organizations. DAV bought all the TV sets for the rooms and things like that. But we don't do well in our solicitations because the comments we receive, well, that's a state program. The state ought to be paying for the operation of it. We have come back to the legislature, and we got authority to create a veterans license plate. The money from that goes to the Veterans Home Trust Fund. We just sold roses for $250 a piece. We have a rose garden up there. We just this is our first year on the state income tax checkoff on the instruction page.
Senator Mass.
John, I'm sorry to cut you off.
Well, you've been doing this for years.
Yeah, you guys have done a great job trying to scrape up resources and put this thing together. But have you looked into the nursing home federal match for people that have basically used up all of the resources? And because we have people now that, in essence, are indigent. They have no resources other than their pension or their Social Security that go into nursing homes, and the federal government kicks in a stipend to pull that together. Are we talking about two different things, or is this the same thing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menace, yes and no. We are talking about if a veteran is in a Medicaid-certified home and he has been receiving a pension from the VA, then the federal law, or Title 38, requires that the pension be reduced to $90 and that $90 be reserved to the individual to meet his personal expenses. It cannot be used to pay for the cost of care,
right,
if he's on Medicaid. That's the same individual that we take into the home, but we don't apply for Medicaid, partly because of what the judge said on the general fund portion.
Pardon? You need a match amount.
We do receive federal funds. The way we pay for it is the veteran is responsible for the cost of care. We can do that currently with the pension, the Social Security, another benefit called aid in attendance, and then we receive a daily per diem from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And then through those dollars that flow in, then we pay back to the contractor. We've worked side deals, so we get all of our medication, drugs, and durable medicals at no cost, which keeps that cost to the veteran down. If we were to be a Medicaid-certified facility, the veteran we come in, his pension would be reduced to $90, and then the state Medicaid would be paying the cost. This is cheaper for the state the way we do it, because there's no state dollars involved in it.
What about when they qualify for Medicare?
For Medicare?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the individuals in the home are, those that are 65 and older are Medicare beneficiaries.
Well, how do the finances work when they qualify for Medicare with the pension?
A person receiving pension can receive Social Security, and then when that person applies for Social Security, the pension is reduced by, if he gets $1,500 on his pension, he gets $300 a month from Social Security, his pension is reduced $300. If he's in a nursing home, when he reaches age 65, he becomes eligible for Medicare Part B. That costs him X dollars, and that's considered a medical expense. The cost of care is considered an ongoing medical expense. So we reduce his countable income, we boost his pension back up to the maximum payable, and in theory, he receives the best of everything. And it could work that way, except for the COLAs have been at 1.2%, and the cost of medical care has far exceeded that. Right now, I think we have 15 individuals that were admitted to the home, could pay for their cost of care, but now the cost of care has exceeded their disposable income, and we are subsidizing them out of the trust fund where we go out and we raise money. And when we do that, we have to set aside roughly 18 months worth of that subsidy, because that's about the average length of stay at the facility. And then if they move out of the facility or pass away during that 18-month period, then the remainder is moved back and we use it for another veteran. But it's happening. It also prevents veterans from coming in because now they're just under what it would take to enter the home, and we can't accept them unless they can pay for their cost of care. Other homes in the nation are Medicaid certified,
right?
And the state is picking up the care. In Georgia, the veteran keeps all of his money, and the state of Georgia pays for the total cost of care. Right. So you could have $1 million in the bank and go in a veteran's home in Georgia, and you're in Fat City. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think. Have you had conversations with the Department of Human Resources on federal match issues, or how you might be able to move on this program?
I don't know of any other federal match. The VA does restrict certain funds, although we are allowed to be Medicaid certified if we want to. But you are restricted on other federal funds.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Are you...
Chairman Corcoran and distinguished committee members, my name is Greg Warnock. I'm the executive director of Oregon Veterans Association, and it is my privilege to present testimony to you today on behalf of Oregon Veterans Association and our War Veteran members in favor of House Bill 2743. Last fall, our political action committee sent questionnaires to all candidates and legislators asking them if they would support our agenda to help veterans. Allowing general funds to be used for Oregon Veterans Home was one of our six agenda items that received overwhelming bipartisan support. Oregon has more war veterans per capita than any other state in the Union. Yet among our 368,000 veterans, Oregon is not known for its excellent reputation for caring for its war heroes. Our state, and indeed our country, has grown a new appreciation for our soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, and Coast Guardsmen who have placed themselves in harm's way to fight for our safety and freedom across our globe. Their willingness to step into danger so that we can enjoy the very freedom we have to even debate this issue today should spawn in all of us a true spirit of humbleness and thanksgiving. Our purpose here today is to ask this committee to pledge a new respect for our war heroes. While this bill may eventually have some fiscal impact, this bill is not about money. It is about hearing the voices of Oregon's war heroes in their time of need. It is about responding to a part of our population who responded to the threat of an enemy knocking at the gate of our happy lifestyle with a huge sacrifice and personal detriment. It is about replacing apathy, ignorance, and confusion with enough courage to fight for those who once fought for us, but who can no longer fight for themselves. Oregon Veterans Home is a place of respect and honor. And since its inception, it has operated solely on the generous donations of charitable contributors and the pensions of its residents. Now with its trust fund in dire jeopardy, due to be depleted next biennium, due to the harsh economy, growing cost of care, and diminished returns on earned interest, the home needs our help. An approval of this bill would not only help save the home for future residents and possibly open the additional wing, but it would be a clear and resounding statement to Oregon's veterans that this state's leadership understands the sacrifices of the few and is willing to reward our most valued citizens with a place to live their last days in dignity. Oregon Veterans Association, our directors, advisors, and most importantly, our war veteran members urge you to unanimously pass this bill. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, may I say one more thing?
Briefly, please.
Representative Mabry said that it could take, if it gets some kind of funding, veterans from around the state. It does take veterans from all over the state at the current time, from the South Coast, Klamath Falls, Metro, down the Valley, Eastern Oregon. So we do have a good cross-section of vets.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Jim Willis and Walter Cruz, please. Welcome back, Jim.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Corcoran and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis. I am the Legislative Commission Chairman for the American Legion Department of Oregon. I will be brief. This bill sends a message that says Oregon values its veterans. That facility in the Dalles is world class. The fact that one of its wings is now closed and we have beds that are sorely needed by veterans that lay empty day after day is a challenge not only to this body but to the veterans who are asking for your support. So we are willing to work with you, and we have. We have done some of this fundraising that Director Mangus talked about. But quite frankly, I've heard some veterans refer to that fundraising and the need to continually add money to the trust fund as something akin to organized begging. Veterans should not have to do that. And the fact that we would even have a bar against the use of general fund for a home such as this is not a good message. Therefore, on behalf of the American Legion, I beseech this committee to favorably view this bill and to pass it out to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I thank you very much for your consideration and for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wells. I think you bring a very good point to bear about the responsibility of good government and the failure in this case of the state to adequately provide, and then you stretch that across our other responsibilities that we're shirking as well. I think that I want to thank you for calling us on that.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Cruz.
For the record, my name is Walter Cruz. I'm the legislative representative for the Noncommissioned Officers Association, and I'm the current chairman of the United Veterans Groups of Oregon. If you look at the back page of my written testimony, you'll see a letterhead for UVGO, and down the left side is a list of the voting member organizations, and I'm sure you'll recognize some of the names. I want to strongly recommend the passing of this measure, this bill. The veterans need a place that will give them shelter when they need it like this. It was a long, hard battle to get this facility put in, and it should not be allowed to go to waste. In fact, as I understand it, if it does close up, then the state of Oregon has to pay back the federal government. And that would not be too great a deal.
We send them enough money already. You're right.
Yeah, they don't need any more. I would like to mention in passing that my organization, NCOA, recently donated $3,500 to the purchase of a piece of physical therapy equipment up there. And other organizations have done likewise. And it's all donated, but I had some problems in going to my organization. They wondered why the state didn't buy some of this stuff. Well, I had to explain to them it's strictly donations. And I would like to see the state accept their responsibility. And as I told Representative Mayberry a while back, I would like to see that facility full and enough people on the waiting list to have us open up a second facility, because we can sure use it. And I want to strongly recommend that you send this out with a DuPass recommendation.
Thanks so much, and thank you for your hard work on the behalf of the vets. Kevin O'Reilly, and I can't read the other name, but the organization is APSA. Can we do any chair moving there for you?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Kevin O'Reilly, and I'm here with the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. And I really can't add much more than has already been said, except for to add our support to this bill. OPVA has long advocated for the best health care for our veterans, for all citizens, but particularly our veterans. And this facility has been mentioned as a model facility for health care. They're not asking for to be totally funded by the state. They're just asking for possibly a little assistance sometime down the future to bring themselves into parity with other facilities of this nature. And as you've already seen, there's a lot of support among veterans groups, both financial and in the way of equipment. And this will probably continue over the years of the facility's life. Our organization has also supplied funding and equipment of all sorts.
Okay, with this.
And we hope to continue doing this in the future. And that's pretty much all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Okay, we're going to close public hearing, open work session on House Bill 2743.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2743 to the Senate floor with a DuPass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 2743 to the to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Menace.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to support the bill, but I do want to have the Department of Veterans Affairs spend a little bit of time dialoguing with Holly Robinson and Legislative Council about how we might be able to maximize the federal match. This is currently not a Medicaid eligible facility, and you know it may or may not be possible to maximize some funds, but I think it's appropriate that we begin to look at whether we can, if we're going to put general fund money in, and it kind of fits into some of the other senior populations that we're trying to deal with in the Health Policy Committee and the whole construct of the Oregon Health Plan and how that functions. So all of this gets to be a huge mystery when you start looking at cash flow in health care, in particular with long-term care facilities. But Holly, I think, is very open. So, John, if you don't mind, I've told her that I would direct you down there, and you know, you guys could have some questions and answers and hopefully get a dialogue started. Maybe we can find some additional ways of financing some of the programs. So
I don't know what you did to irritate Senator Menace to require that you have to go talk to an attorney, but you just did, apparently. So.
But she's a certified smart.
Certified smart attorney. That's right. Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Menace?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. House Bill 2743A passes unanimously to the floor with a due pass. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, great. Senator Menas will carry the bill.
It's interesting, Irv Fletcher's here.
Irv Fletcher is here in a Nike shirt? Wait a minute.
Yeah, they just lost Luke Rittenhouse.
Okay, that's that one. I forgot to let these other two people testify on. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3194. Colleagues, Senator Menas and I heard this bill earlier. It's brought by Representative Shetterly. It passed unanimously in the House, not that we care. And it simply allows cemetery maintenance districts to operate through a board of 3 to 5 directors.
Yeah,
any
bill.
Problem? Okay. Do I hear a motion, please?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr, the competition is starting, apparently, for the floor again. Yes, Senator Starr.
No, see, I just, if the senator from Eugene wants to make the motion, I'd be happy to let her, but I'd move House Bill 3194 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 3194 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Scott?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnis?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3194 to the floor with the due pass, and we will have, whose turn is it? Do you want to carry it, Senator Starr? Senator Starr will carry it. Thank you very much. Okay, you get this back, and we have Representative Hass here, so we will move to Senate Bill, public hearing on Senate Bill 883, please. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Mark Hass, I brought with me today my assistant, who's an attorney, Jason Skellen, who's been researching revolving door acts in Oregon and outside. And I just want to begin with saying I support House Bill 883, along with the many veterans here who came in today to lend their support towards it. Seriously, this is a simple step the legislature can take to win credibility with Oregon citizens. The group Money in Politics reports 25 former legislators are registered lobbyists here in the Oregon Capitol. 5 of them went directly from office to the lobby. And I'm certainly not questioning their integrity, but appearance is important if we want to restore trust in government. The public, as you know, is already jaded about government. Just the suspicion that legislators may spend time ingratiating themselves with prospective employers is enough to keep our citizens steeped in cynicism and mistrust. Governor Kulongoski is right, I believe, when he says we need to regain the credibility of voters. This bill will help do that. Senate Bill 883 simply requires Oregon legislators sit out a session if they want to follow up their public service careers as a paid lobbyist. This is not exactly cutting-edge legislation. 27 states already have some form of revolving door laws for legislators. In fact, Oregon already has a similar ban for administrators of regulatory agencies such as the Oregon Lottery and the Department of Consumer Affairs. And business. They cannot lobby or represent a group with business before the agency for 2 years after leaving their job. If the legislature can impose these laws for administrators, then we should be willing to live under those same laws. Our citizens should be assured that we're looking out for them, not looking for a new job. I know some of you in the past have supported campaign finance reform. I have learned over the last 3 years how difficult and complicated campaign finance reform is. This measure, by comparison, is simple. It's easy. It's effective. I urge you to support Senate Bill 883 and help keep Oregon's government and the perception of Oregon's government clean.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Menas?
Yes, absolutely. Representative Haas, or perhaps your attorney, misplaced your name.
Jason.
Jason Skelton.
Jason, what? How do you spell your last name?
S-K-E-L-T-O-N.
Like red.
All right. Tell me how this prohibition meets constitutional muster.
Sure, Chair Corcoran, and members of the committee. The original version was a strict prohibition of lobbying. Basically said you couldn't lobby for 2 years. The problem with that, or the concern was, that the court might see that as limiting speech. It's political speech, lobbying is, and it's just a flat prohibition with no... And the court's case law, Article 1, Section 8, seems to believe that's too strong a prohibition. So what I did, I tried to change the statute so it regulates something that the legislature can do, which is the harm it's seeking to prevent. And so, as you can see, the statute, or the bill rather, would prohibit former legislators from using their status as a former legislator to get a position as a paid lobbyist. That's something the legislature can regulate. There's statutes now that prohibit state employees and legislators from using their position as a state employee to gain financially. So basically, it's posture is to prevent former legislators from using that status to get a job as a lobbyist. So it's not the speech, it's the status that's being prohibited.
All right. So your suggestion then is that if you're no longer, well, even if you're no longer in office, then your bill would rise to constitutional muster because there's a two-year window, or not a window, actually, a prohibition. There's a two-year period within which you could not exercise your speech as a citizen. And that's permissible, is what you're suggesting. You're suggesting that the harm we're trying to prevent is the status of a former member of the House of Representatives exercising their free speech rights under Article 1, Section 8, and that a two-year period or hiatus is permissible, that the legislature could actually do that. Mm-hmm. And it's justifiable. I guess I'm trying to frame the discussion here.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, sorry, Senator Minnis, it's not a flat prohibition. There's already a process in place, as you know, the Government Standards and Practices Commission. It's basically, if someone has a problem, they file a complaint, and there's a process where the commission can investigate, find some facts, and then, if need be, go forward to a contested case hearing with the court.
Look, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I want to limit it just to the speech aspect of this.
Okay.
I mean, State v. Henry and subsequent cases dealing with finance talk about money. Money is, in fact, speech, and that's why we can't limit contributions. Mm-hmm. And that's why, subsequently, I think there was an attorney general's opinion that said that you cannot limit the ability to accept money mm-hmm. during a legislative session. At the time you have the status that you're saying is the harm you're seeking to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
So if the acceptance of money, which is speech, during the course of a legislative session, although it may not be wise to accept money, is constitutional, then how is it that a two-year hiatus meets the test of constitutionality? Because you've got a two-year period where you're basically saying you can't do this for money or otherwise, because you can actually be a non-paid lobbyist. Mm-hmm. Goes to
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, it's not a strict prohibition. If you, like, for example, say you have an area of expertise you had before you were in the legislature.
Before, Mr. Chair, before you go on,
sure.
Actually, this would have to be financial gain, Senator Minnis.
Right. Okay. So you have to be paid.
Correct.
Okay.
And you also have to be using your status as a former legislator to get the job exclusively. So, for example, yeah, it seems odd, but that's the Oregon constitutional framework seems to suggest this is the only way you can get at this issue. So what I was envisioning was that if you had an area of expertise you had before you entered the legislature, an engineer, for example, or anything of that sort, then after your service in the legislature, you want to lobby for an organization that represented that interest. Well, it's a pretty easy case that, well, you probably got that job not exclusively based on your status as a former legislator, but as your expertise as an engineer or whatever you had before. And so the case that this would prohibit would be a case where you got a job, something totally foreign to whatever area of expertise you had before. So the suggestion would be that you got that job as a lobbyist, a paid lobbyist, exclusively, solely based on your status as a former legislator. And that's all this prohibits. So it's a narrowly drafted statute as opposed to the more broadly drafted statute originally, which is, other states have, which is a flat prohibition for 2 years as a lobbyist.
So, Mr. Chairman, the assumptions behind the prohibition is that the person who would be subjected to this has somehow obtained expertise as a legislator that would gain access to employment or qualify them for employment in a particular field or area. Is my following correctly?
Chair Corcoran, Senator, I don't think I understand.
Well, let's say I've been in the legislature for
19 years now. I've been a policeman, a police detective, and I've chaired the Judiciary Committee and Ways and Means and a whole bunch of different areas. Frankly, I feel like a jack of all trades, a master of absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that any of my experience qualifies me for anything, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. But what is the assumption behind the prohibition? What are we assuming is the problem? You said that this person would have gained some expertise or some mm-hmm. background or something that would be the primary reason why they obtained the job. I guess I'm trying to figure out in reality what that might be or how that would happen.
Mr. Chair, just for a correction, I think what he said is that what the law is drawn tightly in that it says that if you had expertise prior to being in the legislature
right.
in a certain area
right.
and then went on to lobby afterwards, then that expertise could be seen as the rationale. If you had none previously, then there might be a question of whether you got the position because you were a legislator. Is that a fair...
That's correct, Chair Corcoran, yes.
Give me some examples. You have an example of where that would work?
I got one I can think of.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menes, an example of what this statute would prohibit, like a hypothetical?
What is it we're exactly trying to prohibit here?
If I could just weigh in here just one second, Mr. Chair and Senator Menes, is I think the obvious ones are influence and connections the legislator has into making law that ordinary citizens would not have, and therefore... that influence, those connections, may be of value to an outside third party that an ordinary citizen might not have access to. And I don't think it seems unreasonable to say that a person should sit out for at least a session so that they can never be allowed or be perceived to allow to trade on that influence or those connections.
All right, Mr. Chairman, now you kind of changed the framework on me, and I'm not sure if I'm understanding this now, because you just said influence and connections.
Mm-hmm.
And that's almost an intangible as compared to what your attorney said. With respect to gain knowledge or skills in a subject area other than what you possess first in the legislature. So are they the same thing? Are they different? Or?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menes.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, the idea is that if you get a job as a paid lobbyist exclusively based on your status as a former legislator, the idea is that those connections and the influence that you gained while serving in the legislature is what got you the job, is what you're trading on to get that job as a lobbyist. And the legislature has the power under Article 1, Section 8, in my view, and that they can regulate that.
All right, so again, Mr. Chairman, I hate to belabor this, because what I'm trying to understand is, if the assumption behind the prohibition is that members of the Legislative Assembly inherently gain an influence and an understanding of connections, who's connected to who or how systems flow, And that's the evil we're trying to present or prevent. That's one thing. But I thought you talked about a skill or knowledge base that preexisted the legislative membership, and that if you had gained skills that were of the same nature, that would be okay, and you could defend yourself, basically. For instance, if I left the legislature and I went to lobbied for the Oregon State Bar, not that they've offered me a job, they have not, but I'm a policeman, I've chaired the Judiciary Committee. So would I be able to say, well, no, in fact, I didn't use my legislative experience because I'm a policeman, or I've been a policeman, I've spent 27 years in law enforcement, and there's a logical nexus between law enforcement and lobbying for the Oregon State Bar, where, in fact, criminal defense lawyers and prosecutors are certified to practice law. So again, I'm trying to figure out how I would defend myself, and that's another problem, by the way, because it puts me in the defensive. Clearly, I would have to be defending myself in some form, and I'm not sure exactly what that would be. Help me understand.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menes, I think your example illustrates exactly why this is constitutional. It shows why it's not overbroad. As you know, that if you want to regulate something, regulate speech in Oregon, you can't be overbroad. We can regulate the harm, but we can't be overbroad. In your situation, that's reasonable people could perhaps disagree about that. So it's not a flat prohibition on you being a paid lobbyist. So that it illustrates why this is not overbroad. You see my point?
Well, Mr. Chairman, okay, let's assume you're correct. But what form in which would I be offered or afforded the privilege of saying, I didn't get this job based on my legislative experience. In fact, what form would that happen in? Is it the public sector, the newspapers, the press, the Ethics Commission? How does that happen?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, the Ethics Commission. The way the process works...
Oh, that makes me real comfortable.
I want to go back to the Oregon State Bar lobbying. Do you think you would run that terrorism bill through there?
There are certain sections of the bar that you could get it through.
That's it.
I'm saying. Well, but again, and let me just state the point. Influence and connections. I would submit is speech, and it's a form of speech. But the way you get around the speech question is by saying that there's a particular harm. Correct? State v. Stoneman talks about the harm to children, and et cetera, and child abuse cases, and pornography, and so on and so forth. State v. Henry's the big major free speech case in Oregon. There have been some subsequent ones, but so again, the harm is defined as what? I mean, you have to have an identified harm.
Sure.
And for instance, in child pornography cases, it is the threat to the child's welfare that is the harm that makes, pictures of children engaged in sexual conduct child pornography. And even in State v. Stoneman, in a recent federal case, you have to have an actual child and not pictures are generated via, computer. Mm-hmm. What's the harm we're trying to identify here?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, the harm here is... legislators using their status as a former legislator, trading on that status as a former legislator to get a job as a lobbyist. As far as the policy reason of whether that's a good idea or bad idea or, poppycock, I mean, that's not the legal question. The legal question is that a harm? The legislature can find it a harm and regulate that.
The legislature can, Mr. Chairman, the legislature can find it a harm? We can just declare it a harm.
Senator Minnis, just to reinforce the point that there's already these laws that exist in the same statute.
Right. Many of our laws that are currently in statute are unconstitutional, currently under existing case law. We just haven't changed them because it's pretty embarrassing to do that. The gift limitation, for instance, is unconstitutional.
I'd like to go to a different question I have is that this wouldn't apply in the case of, or do other states have laws that apply to a case when you have a legislator who is an ongoing lobbyist and you have special sessions, for instance, after the regular session? This doesn't get at that problem, does it?
Chair Corcoran, let me think. Yes, well, I think it would. I think as drafted, no, you're right, because they would still be a legislator.
And that is legal right now.
Well, in the current...
You could ostensibly be both a lobbyist and a legislator right now, a paid lobbyist and a legislator at the same time.
I would answer, but Senator Minnis seems like he has an answer to offer.
This might cause a stampede to become lobbyist before you get out of office.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, members of the committee, there are some ethics laws that say you can't use your public office for personal gain, and that is where there may be a problem there.
There's a few. Currently, you can't. The way the statute's written now, a legislator can only be paid by Oregon, the state of Oregon, to lobby. So that's basically what it says. So if you're a state legislator, you can lobby because that's probably your job is to get bills passed and talk to people and get things done. But when you're doing so, you can be paid only by the state of Oregon. So that's the current prohibition.
So you're saying that if someone were were on salary while they were in a term of office, and they were on salary from somewhere outside the state of Oregon, that they would be technically in violation of the law?
Senator Chair Corcoran, if they were lobbying for that organization, if they were paid by that organization that was not part of the state of Oregon to lobby, that would violate current state statutes, as I understand them, and yes, I understand them.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I'd like to squeeze in here. Thank you. And you asked the question that I wanted to ask, and I'd really, gentlemen and Representative Hass, if you could cite me to the statute, because my concern is this issue came up because of last session when the House Speaker became executive director or public affairs director for the Oregon Nurserymen Association. We know that. I don't think there was anything in the law that said he couldn't do that. That seems to be more of the issue than what I choose to do when I'm done being a legislator. So I'd like you to cite me to an area in the statute or the ethics law that says I cannot be a lobbyist during session. And if we don't have such a law, why don't we have that for us today?
You know what I think we'll do, Senator Walker? It might be fairer to Mr. Skelton is to, at some, we can reschedule, we can schedule this for another hearing and bring in Pat Hearn, because he should be the one that should be giving us advice on that. On whether or not there was a, it's a technical violation to collect money from an outside source as a lobbyist while you're in your term of office.
Again, I don't know, if I understand correctly, I don't know much about that case, that particular situation, except that the former speaker was hired as an executive director of an organization. And I don't know that his job duties were defined as political lobbying.
I don't either.
Day-to-day administration. So, I mean, I would rather that we not focus on a particular individual than talk about factual circumstances or identify a specific harm that,
well, that
we're trying to prevent. So
that's my intent.
Because I think that's a more salient question. I don't think the legislature can simply declare a harm statutorily and have it meet constitutional muster. We've attempted to do that in pornography cases before, specific, and the courts have struck us down time and again. We've done it with gift limitations. We've done it with accepting contributions during session. And the problem really isn't the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The problem is Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, which provides a greater protection to free speech than does probably any other constitution of any state in the Union. And Oregon is very different. That's why we have hundreds of adult bookstores and, you know, nude dancing establishments in the Portland metropolitan area, actually more than they have in Los Angeles County, because that's the freedom of speech right that our courts have granted and our citizens have chosen to accept. So, you know, you, when you get to free speech, it gets to be a very interesting discussion, and I love this stuff, because, you know, at what point can you step in and say, you can't do that, but you can, and it's very intriguing to me. I love these discussions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we went through this with Legislative Council, too, and perhaps we should give you a copy of a memorandum between us. And,
sure.
And that is one of the reasons we tried to make this as narrow as possible and have achieved that, at least through that legal bar. So we're working very hard on those very issues. And as I mentioned, we got caught up in this, obviously, with the campaign finance reform, where you do this and something else happens. And, mm-hmm. and it's that interpretation of our own state constitution that's causing us either problems or more freedom, depending on where you come down.
And, Mr. Chair, I had one other comment to make.
Senator Walker.
It struck me as kind of amusing that we are actually so expendable and forgettable that in 2 years' time you think our influence has decreased so that we can come back and be a lobbyist and have...
What was your name again? Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Janice Thompson. Welcome back, Janice.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, I'm Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. And we do support this legislation primarily because it seems to represent what we think is an important step in restoring public trust in the political process. You've obviously had an extensive discussion related to the legal issues. I kind of anticipated that and want to zero in on recognizing that this legislation also raises really tough questions related to the dynamic tension, if you will, between an Oregon priority on having a citizen legislature and the need for what I want to really acknowledge are very poorly paid legislators, you know, to earn a living. For that reason, you can kind of, you know, read through. I have a couple of, suggestions in here related to possible amendments to the current to the language as it's currently written. But to zero in on Senator Walker's point, We also recognize that this legislation might reduce the likelihood of the situation that you alluded to that occurred last spring. But I don't think it would absolutely eliminate that possibility, which points to potentially tackling, you know, a not necessarily completely mutually exclusive strategy that zeroes in more on either through legislation or through the legislator's internal conflict of interest rules, strengthening some of the procedures to deal with those kind of more targeted circumstances, and not worrying so much about post-legislative session employment. So I just want to really acknowledge that these are really tough issues, and so you know, there may be, like I say, I don't think something like that that's targeted on that issue would be mutually exclusive with this bill, but to a certain extent we're kind of identifying two separate issues, and so there may be a need to kind of zero in on that other topic. And then the other issue that I do want to raise is that as an organization, we really think it's worth discussion about the idea of raising legislative pay. I mean, I think the notion of a citizen legislature is very important, and obviously we need to have a balance between that value and that priority and not having pay be to the extent that, you know, people should be running for office because they want to be a public servant and they're willing to put in the time, not because they're going to, you know, be making a lot of money. At the same time, it seems like that balance is out of whack.
It seems like this is way off the subject.
Well, so I'm going to just wind it up.
Okay.
Don't worry.
I'm not worried. I would like you to just speak to, you know, the legislative salaries and what a legislator does 2 years later as a paid lobbyist really doesn't seem to be relevant whatsoever.
The reason I bring it up is because it seems like part of the puzzle of, like, why certain people need to make certain kinds of decisions about employment. So that's all.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions, Senator Menace?
Are you an attorney?
No.
Congratulations. That's a good. I'm just wondering too. I'll put this out. This thing, as it's constructed, says use or attempt to use the person's position as a member of the legislative assembly to obtain financial gain. I'm not sure, and I made a note here what use or attempts to use means in the context of the person's former position, legislative assembly. I think that forward, it has to have a more clear definition. But then the next question is whether or not, because it focuses only on former members of the Legislative Assembly, if there's not an equal protection issue or prison issue with respect to other elected officials. In other words, if you're an elected official in Multnomah County, which is a very large county with a large percentage of population, do they, as a member of the county commission, not have sufficient experience and or connections or as influence, et cetera, to, you know, rise to the level of harm that would also want to prohibit in this? If you understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Either you do them all or you don't do any.
Well, or is that a more appropriate topic for, you know, a county commission to, you know, no, it's a very valid concern.
Okay. I mean, Mr. Chairman, I guess I think if the legislature is going to do this, I think it has to be a referral, and I think Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution to really clarify that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none,
well,
thank you.
Actually, I have one, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
And Ms. Thompson alluded to it. I think what I'm more interested in doing is just eliminating the political activity of someone while they're serving.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you'd have to define it as actively engaged in legislative session, because we engage in political activity as soon as we leave the building. So I think that's where I'm more interested in going than prohibiting what we all do with our personal lives when we're done with our public service. And maybe you can respond to that.
Well, that's Senator Walker, Chair Corcoran. I mean, that's why I raised that issue and pointed out the ways in which the Senate bill is particularly, as it's written right now, addresses that kind of in an indirect kind of way, which therefore points to the opportunity to take a little bit more targeted approach.
Mm-hmm.
So I concur with you. and would be, you know, really open to figuring out how to do that. But it's tough, I think.
I got another question. It kind of goes to the core of this harm thing. Now, when you're in the legislature, you meet a lot of media people, television, radio, newspaper, print. Now, if you left your legislative service and you became a reporter, is that a similar harm to getting a job lobbying in favor of a particular interest, where you might be writing stories about particular activity? And I'm saying this to say that you may have a very extensive knowledge of the inner workings of the Legislative Assembly, how it works, what the process is, how a bill becomes law, et cetera. And that knowledge can be profitable to a newspaper organization or radio, Lars Larson, whatever, assuming that he discussion on fact. But wouldn't we want to also prohibit that? If they're going to pay him a salary to do it,
I would leave
their knowledge.
I would leave the attorney who was here before to address that.
Well, I'm saying these rhetorically because, you know, a rhetorical question, usually you know the answer. I'm saying it, I guess, as a...
We're just about to end this rhetorical here.
I love this stuff.
I understand. I'm really happy you're happy.
Same judiciary. We'll fix it up.
Yeah. I might. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Anybody else wanting to testify? Close the work session or close the public hearing on Senate Bill 883, and we will open. We'll do this. Let's do this one real quickly. I think we can do this quickly. Let's open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 876, please. Could you tell us what that does, Mr. Ellsworth?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 876 changes from 20,000 to 25,000 the minimum county population at which an individual must be a resident of the county to be eligible for office of county surveyor.
And we have Gary Lee DeJarnett. Welcome. Stephen Kafori. And Randy Hildebrand. And I got fully filled in last night by Marla Ray about your entire life.
All right.
So welcome to the Capitol.
All right, thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. And for the record, Mr. Chair, there were 4 years that elapsed between the end of my legislative career and the beginning of my career as a lobbyist.
Mr. Kafori, we didn't even remember that you served in the legislature.
I know. It was back in the dark ages. I have with me Gary DeJarnett, who's the Jefferson County Surveyor. Just wanted to introduce him and let him to know that the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon is supportive of his bill.
Thank you. This one looks pretty straightforward. Go ahead.
Hi, Chair and committee members. I'm Gary DeJarnett. I'm self-employed. I have a business in Deschutes County, but I'm also the county surveyor in Jefferson County, and I've been the county surveyor since 1988. And historically and presently, the county surveyors east of the Cascade are usually part-time, have their own business, and then they also have their county surveying position. So the county surveying position historically has been part-time. There's just maybe one or two counties on the east side. There's about two or three of us that do live outside the county. In Central Oregon, there's probably about 30 or 40 surveyors that we have there, but the selection for Jefferson County has been anybody could run for that if they lived outside the county. But if the population gets over the 20,000, the way that the law exists right now, you have to move to the county. And so at least I'm in favor of this Senate Bill 876, and I have a packet there, and I probably have about seven letters from people in the community that just support that they want to see that this bill pass.
Okay, thank you very
much.
Yeah. Any questions, Senator Walker? For fun, if this, we'll have to get a quorum here, but I think nobody seems to have any problem with this. There's no opposition to this, as far as you know, Mr. Kafori.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Okay, well...
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, may I say something on the record? It's Randy Hildebrand, Chief Staff for Senator Clarno's office, and we introduced this at the request of Gary, obviously. Even though Bev does not represent Jefferson County any longer, she does represent Gary as a constituent in Bend. Mm-hmm. And if you pass this measure, it allows the voters of Jefferson County a choice on this issue. Currently, I think there's only one licensed surveyor in Jefferson County, and that would be the only person eligible once the county population increases to greater than 20,000. So this is really kind of an issue of choice for the voters. So I would appreciate your favorable consideration of this measure.
How far would you physically have to move to be in Jefferson County?
Oh, well, at least from where I live, to get to Madras is a 40-minute drive. So driving to the county line is probably about a 25-minute drive.
Okay. But you're not planning on moving me?
No.
All right. Well, I think what we'll do is close the hearing, and when we get a quorum back and they're okay with the bill, we'll move forward.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to quickly, another piece of business that I would like to get done is Senate Bill 325. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 325.
Yes. Not enough folks here.
Oh, excuse me, you're right, I can't. Okay, let's open the public hearing, close the work session on 325, open the public hearing on Senate Bills 725 and 726.
Oh, you've got to come on.
Well, we'll have to wait for a minute now. I think what I'm going to do is, since we got our quorum, are you fine with that last bill?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to hang on just a minute here, Randy. I'm going to close the public hearing on 725 and 726 and reopen the public hearing on, work session on
876.
Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
I would move Senate Bill 876 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 876 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, you call the roll, please.
Senator Sommer?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Chair Corcoran?
Aye. Senate Bill 876 to the floor. Senator Walker, you want to carry it? All right, Senator Walker will carry it, and we'll close that hearing. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 325. Colleagues, the last time we left this bill, there were three amendments before us. We've amended in the dash three amendment.
That includes all three.
Okay. That includes all three then. And we are. I would suggest that we not proceed with the dash fours, which would have opened it up to all of the law enforcement folks in any size community. There was discussion about waiting to hear if there was interest in the so-called drop plan. And what we've heard from that is that there's very strong opposition in the building to the drop plan by the local governments and school districts. So I don't think that's worth pursuing. So I would.
You need a motion.
I need a motion to move the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 325 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I thought we had.
We don't have the dash threes in the bill already.
So
I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 325.
Thank you very much. Well, let's check with staff here.
Doesn't indicate in my notes.
We've already done it. So Senator Starr's original motion is to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Oh, yes, because dash three on 49. Okay.
No. Seeing none, Ms. Bell, call the roll, please.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 325 to the floor with a due pass, and I'll carry it. Close that hearing, and we will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bills 725 and 726.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Hildebrand, Chief of Staff for the Senate Republican Office. As you may know, Senator Clarno has been working tirelessly to earn the reputation of a taxpayer watchdog, particularly scrutinizing the operation of state-owned vehicles. As you know, Oregon owns over 11,000 state vehicles that travel over 70 million miles each year. These vehicles are spread across dozens of state agencies with little or no cost containment mechanisms. Several agencies own and operate their own fleet of vehicles, and many others contract with Department of Administrative Services for their vehicles. The Department of Administrative Services operates three motor pools, Portland, Salem, and Eugene. Actually, it's in Springfield. DAS rents to agencies day trip vehicles, those that are typically checked out every day, on a daily basis, rather, and permanently assigned vehicles, those that are contracted for a longer period of time. It's my understanding it's about 6 months or more that meets that criteria. Even though DAS performs better than every other state agency, Senator Clarno's office has shown that there are literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in savings that could be and actually are being realized through increased efficiencies at the department. It is impossible, nearly impossible, to make a case that we can save taxpayers money unless we get a true cost comparison of what it takes to operate a state vehicle. If you were a state agency up to several years ago, you were able to log on to the state webpage and rent a car for $15 a day. One would assume that's what it costs for the state to operate that vehicle. It's actually closer to $40 a day that the state it costs the state to operate that vehicle. With the Senate Task Force on State-Owned Vehicle Efficiency, we were able to arrive at that true cost of operating that state vehicle. Now we're able to make a true apples-to-apples comparison with the private sector and show that we are able to save the state money in this area. As you can see from the table that I've attached to the back of your my testimony, the consultant that we contracted with, DAS contracted with, was Maximus Group, which is very up on this kind of performance review. The Salem Motor Pool, for example, had been stocking their inventory at a point which met the peak demand periods. I believe it's Tuesday through Thursday. After looking at this, the consultant reviewed that level of vehicle status and basically recommended that out of the 155 cars in the Salem Motor Pool, they reduce that fleet by 55 vehicles and contract out, I call it the fluff, to the private sector. That way, when you hit the peak demand, you don't have a car that has been sitting idle on the lot. You contract that out with the private sector. The consultant, in further review, has shown that the private sector can compete on a very competitive basis, and in my document I've showed that a copy of the table from the Maximus report that shows the state can do it. The state is doing it for several dollars more than the private sector can now. The table shows that pickups currently, or up until several months ago, the state was charging state agencies $86 for a pickup when the private sector can actually provide that pickup for $31 a day. So that's a savings of $50 per vehicle. Similar situation with station wagons. State charges agencies $62, and the private sector can provide that exact same vehicle for $37. So the DAS has implemented that process where they're contracting out the station wagons and pickups. They've also, due to the task force recommendation, eliminated a redundant fuel attendant. I believe that was $70,000 a year and 1.5 FTE. That money now can be either better utilized in their own budget or sent back to the general fund. When I was involved with this at the get-go. We had a lot of discussions, and I got to compliment the folks at DAS. They're very workable on this situation. One of the things that I asked is if a state car breaks down in Ontario that was rented from the Salem Motor Pool, how do you get a replacement vehicle for that state worker? Currently, two other state cars are dispatched to Ontario where they drop off the vehicle and pick up the driver of that ferried vehicle. The private sector is willing to do that. That is a standard operating procedure for the private sector to provide that replacement vehicle at the location for no extra cost. You find a similar situation where if the state employee does not reside close to a motor pool operation, how do they actually pick up that car? It's questionable whether they do that on their own time or have a fellow state employee in a state car take them to the motor pool. There are literally dozens of these kind of situations, and as I said earlier, DAS is the best ran fleet in the state. One of the recommendations of the consultant was to have almost every other state agency consolidated under DAS, and I would encourage that to happen. However, DAS has spending limitations that will prevent it from agreeing to facilitate that transfer because they have to commit to buying new cars, and they are currently unable to commit to that situation because of their appropriation limitations. Senate Bill 725 directs the state to sell those three motor pool lots and contract for the private sector to provide for fleet management services. 726 basically takes on the rest of the state agencies and forces them to consolidate with DAS. So with that, I'd like to open it up or transfer it over to one of my private sector experts, Kevin Neri from Enterprise.
Okay. Hello. I am Kevin Neri. I represent Catrala. I'm with Enterprise Rent a Car, but I represent Catrala, the Car and Truck Rental and Leasing Association, Oregon chapter. I'm here just to represent the facts as stated, that we believe there's considerable savings due to the state should some or all of the cars that are currently in the motor pool fleet be done away with and contracted out through the private sector.
And, Mr. Chair, I have been working with your committee staff on revising the amendments, -1, -2, into a -4 amendments. We're working with DAS on changing some of the language. In our initial conversations with DAS, and some of the other experts recommended we do it through attrition, basically not forcing every state agency to turn over their vehicles tomorrow, but do it through a very thoughtful process where you would tie it to the age or the mileage on the vehicle. I believe -2s are written with a 70,000-mile criteria, and I would support DAS's recommendation to bump it up to 100,000 miles. So as a department had a vehicle that reached 100,000 miles, they would be required to either consolidate under DAS or sell that vehicle. And I sure would appreciate your support of this measure.
Any questions? Seeing none. Senator, thank you very much. Senator Deckard, welcome to reality.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the Senate General Government Committee, I'm Ryan Deckert, State Senator from Beaverton and Southwest Portland. I will take no more than 3 minutes. I wanted to update the committee on, first, what I would say is tepid opposition to this proposal, because it was one that we looked at in the 97 session, and I actually...
Tepid? Is that a Beaverton word, tepid?
I think it's mild or not severe. But I worked with Randy, Mr. Chair, and he was incredibly helpful in the 1997 session where we really took a look at it, and we started with the premise that we would sell the motor pool. We would do this. We would just privatize it. And what we found in pretty exhaustive work is that that really saves the state no money, but it ends up costing the state money because of the really ins and outs of the functionings of the motor pool and state employees who utilize it. What we also found was that the state had way too many vehicles And so we worked with several of the individuals that are here to look at what are the private rental car companies, how do they manage their fleets, which are somewhat similar to our state motor pool fleets and their usage. And we wrote the formula into statute that they use. And I don't remember, but you have the statute in front of you. I don't remember it exactly, but I think it's around for every 6 months we have to run a mileage test on the cars. And that's what Enterprise and other rental car companies do to just determine, are these cars being used efficiently and effectively, and are we getting our biggest bang for our buck? I know we realized a great deal of savings following the implementation of that, because we were just simply, through state statute, mandated to sell a large portion of vehicles that weren't being used efficiently. I came to the conclusion, and I think we really should embed in that legislation, and this was part of the negotiations that the whole group had, was an exclusion that we gave to DAS. And I always felt the exclusion we gave was a little bit too high. Now, you always have cases, and Randy probably talked about it, you have cases whether it's a child caseworker who you cannot mandate to take a private vehicle. It's certainly not more cost-effective for that child caseworker to go and rent a vehicle than it would be the current system we have. So you always have to mandate some exceptions. I forget the exact percentage that we gave the director of DAS, but we allowed them a decent size percentage that they could accept out, so that you run the formula on the vehicle, and it's not cost efficient. It's not in the state's fiscal interest to have this vehicle. Then we allowed, and I think that's where the ball game is on this motor pool debate. And I've kind of followed it because I've seen so many ideas of let's just privatize and sell the motor pool, and I've never thought. And it could have changed in the last few years, but in my best estimate, it doesn't save the state. It ends up costing the state. But I think the ballgame is in that 10 to 20% that we left for an exception. That was a pretty high exception rate. Is that the appropriate amount? Because I think if we keep the formula in place, if the intent is to keep the size of the motor pool down, which should be, and ensure that every vehicle that we have is really being used efficiently, then I think we'll have achieved at least part of our ultimate goal, which is to really ensure that that state motor pool, that agency, is running as effectively and efficiently as possible. So I just wanted to come. This is a debate, and I've worked with the proponents of this through the years on this. Why we're all interested in this issue is probably beyond me, but I think it's kind of an interesting one, and I think at least my best estimate is that the best way to do this is really look at that percentage of exclusion that we've allowed the director of DAS, and is that too wide, and there are too many cars being excluded that should actually be sold.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Did you, Senator Deckard, when you were doing this research in 97 pursuant to the bill, did you look at any studies that were done, privatization studies done in any other states or governmental structures?
You know what we did? I think we originally drafted the bill to privatize, to just sell the state motor pool and get rid of it. And what we found was that by just going to private vehicle reimbursement, which is 33 cents on the mile or whatever the federal rate is, that worked on some cases, but in general, employing all rental companies and or contracting out to rental companies would not actually save the state money. And we just ran the numbers ourselves. And so then we got into, and there was a Secretary of State audit that assisted us a great deal on this. How do you do it better? And at least this is what we came up with, is the most efficient way. And we really borrowed heavily. Well, not heavily. We borrowed exactly from how Enterprise or Hertz or other large motor pools run their fleets to have the optimal number of the smallest number of vehicles that you could possibly have.
I wonder if you had any discussion about, liability. It sounds simple to say, tell a state worker to use their own vehicle and they'll get reimbursed at 33 cents a mile. But was there any discussion about what it's like to try to get insurance if you're using your car for the purpose of work? I understand the exceptions in child welfare and that sort of thing, and those would stand out really obviously. But, an adult and family service food stamp worker, if asked to use his or her own car to drive every day from Eugene to Oak Ridge, would incur a lot of mileage in a very short time, and I just wondered if that person got in an accident, going to work, is there an effect on their insurance? It seems that it would raise a lot of questions
in that regard?
We did not.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. How about, I hesitate to do this, but I'm going to ask Das to come up here. Cam Burney. This is the new cowboy version of Das that doesn't keep everybody informed what they're doing. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cam Burney. I administer the Procurement, Fleet, and Surplus Services Division in DAS. I come forward to you with some comments on Senate Bill 726, but not on 725. At this time, DAS cannot support 726. DAS does remain a proponent of consolidation of state-owned vehicle resources when it makes economic sense to do so. And indeed, since the early 90s, DAS has consolidated other agency fleets and has, as a result of these agreements, has delivered more cost-effective vehicle services to these agencies than they were able to provide for themselves initially. DAS believes that whatever agency fleets should be targeted for consolidation should be determined by several factors, including the following. Number one, we should identify the more poorly performing state agency fleets. Biennially, DAS is required by statute to perform a management analysis of state agency fleets, and we typically contract that out, most recently with Maximus Incorporated, to determine which might be the more performing state agency fleets. Another factor, identifying those agencies which desire to be consolidated. Currently, ODOT and DAS are under discussions relating to the consolidation of ODOT vehicles. Third, identify those agencies that have statutory authority to own and operate their own fleets. We'd have to take that into consideration. And fourth, Randy Hildebrand mentioned spending limitation. We have to be appreciative of the fact of what our financial ability is to acquire agency vehicles from other agencies. DAS is similarly a proponent of an active user of outsourcing when there are, again, compelling economic reasons for doing so. Indeed, the motor pool outsources much of its maintenance services throughout the state and currently contracts, as Mr. Hildebrand indicated, with private vehicle lease companies to provide several day-use vehicles at the Portland, Springfield, and Salem Motor Pool sites. As written, Senate Bill 726 touches upon both consolidation and outsourcing, and it directs a number of agencies to dispose of their sedan, station wagons, and pickup trucks. But this direction is made without there being targeting, without there being consideration for which agencies might be most prone where it makes economic sense to pursue this task, this direction. So targeting is the key in consolidation and outsourcing, and with that, I rest my testimony. Thank you.
All right. I've got a question for you. Indemnification of the state's motor pool, how does that occur?
Oh, brother, I should, Mr. Chair, I should have brought a person from risk management along, but relating to a person driving state motor pool car on state business and how that person is covered?
I suppose that would be an area we'd need to indemnify, but what about if a state vehicle driven by a state employee is outside of their work or their job description, so to speak?
Yeah.
They're driving a vehicle to take their child or family to the grocery store. And I'm saying this because we actually had a situation in Portland where Portland police employees...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, our vehicle policies do address this. Actually, Oregon Administrative Rules do address this in detail, mm-hmm. where especially if a state employee is engaged in something beyond... work during the daytime, is engaged in overnight trips, there's a little more leniency for where that person can go, such as to restaurants, perhaps to a laundromat, perhaps to a movie theater. It's laid out, and I'd be happy to get you copies of this rule, and agencies are guided by those guidelines.
Sir, I'm Mr. Chairman, I assume we have rules, but I guess my question goes more to if a state employee who's authorized to have a vehicle or they're using it during the course of their work, they pick up their brother-in-law and, you know, drive down the street to go do an errand, and they're involved in an accident. The situation in the Portland case, the passenger in the vehicle was not authorized to be in the car, and the injuries that that person sustained were not covered by the insurance company, or I'm not sure if Portland's indemnified, self-insured or not. We are, but I don't know what we do in terms of those kind of rules and whether we've suffered losses based on that kind of a scenario as a state. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, I would think that I would want risk management here to provide a crisp, accurate answer to that, but I suspect that person might be on thin ice, the driver.
Right, but what about, again, the passenger? I don't know whether we're indemnifying them, paying their medical bills, if there is an accident. I'm assuming we do have accidents from time to time or wouldn't have risk management. Do you know how many individuals in the state of Oregon are, state employees are authorized to take home vehicle?
I can ask Ford. The fleet manager, Rod Lohop, is in the room, and he'd probably have a better estimate than that than I would, if I could, Mr. Chair.
He has a very blank look on his face, but bring him on up. It's the old deer in the headlights look.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Rod Lohop, and I manage the DAS fleet. Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't think that we have an accurate number of those that are authorized. The authorization is done at the agency level. We do not keep track of that.
Okay.
Would you like to get
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a very valid point. Again, in my experience, the city of Portland, they've restricted take-home vehicles for a very specific purpose because, as my neighbor Bob was complaining to me this weekend, that he sees state vehicles wandering around on Saturdays and Sundays with their families rolling around in them, and may or may not be a factual circumstance, but that's what he observed. And the question he posed to me is why would we have state employees working on Saturday or Sunday driving around with their families in a DAS-owned vehicle? So
I would think that would be a pretty clear violation of policy.
So if we don't know how many people are authorized to take home vehicle, I think we ought to know how many people are authorized, and we ought to know why they're authorized, and we ought to know how we're insuring them and why we're insuring them and under what circumstances we're insuring them, because that is a larger cost.
Yeah.
So you may be able to own a fleet of vehicles, but if you're letting everybody drive them at any time of day or night without restriction and we subsequently suffer a loss via an accident, there's an associated cost with that, too.
Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, within the OAR, or Administrative Rules, we have a specific section dealing with, it's called garaging, and those conditions under which it is permissible with agency permission to take a vehicle home. And to
maybe, Mr. Chairman, if we could we get information relevant to how many accidents, motor vehicle accidents, there were in state-owned vehicles last year?
We can find that for you.
Whether any individuals in state employment were disciplined as a matter, not by name, but whether or not they were disciplined for bad driving.
Sure.
And do we send them to driving school if they have more than one?
I backed into a, when I worked for the state, into a concrete thing that wasn't there the moment before. And I think I got a letter in my file saying you backed into this unknown concrete object, but I didn't get disciplined.
Now, didn't you have a certain member of the governor's staff back into one of your cars?
That was a personal vehicle, sir.
And my wife still doesn't know about that, so would you please
strike that from the record?
All right, thank you very much.
Minimum damage, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Okay, and we will have, finally, hitting cleanup, Michael Slater from SEIU.
Dubious honor of being the last person on a long day.
That's right, and you know what that means, don't you?
It means I'll be short, yes.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Slater, political director for SEIU, Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. As you can imagine, we are opposed to Senate Bill 725. We believe that the DAS motor pool has gone through a number of studies and examinations of its efficiency. It's gotten excellent ratings in terms of service. It's seen as cost effective. It's considered flexible and meeting the needs of the public employees. Also, the studies have identified areas where it could be more efficiently, where it would have been more efficient to outsource it, and they've engaged in that. We think the system works as it is, and we don't believe that it should be changed.
And with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you very much. Questions? Seeing none, close the public hearings on 725 and 726, and we will adjourn. Thank you, colleagues.